The explosive new film, Flynn, Deliver the Truth, Whatever the Cost, exposes secrets behind the government's takedown of General Michael Flynn.
Flynn knew what the intel world had been up to.
He ordered the first audit of the use of contractors. This set off alarm bells.
He told the truth. He was the most dangerous person for Donald Trump to hire. They had to get rid of Flynn.
Flynn, Deliver the Truth, Whatever the Cost. Available now. Watch it today. Go to SalemNow.com. SalemNow.com.
The following is a conversation between Rebecca Van Bergen, founder and executive director of Nest, and Denver Frederick, host of The Business of Giving, on AM 970 The Answer WNYM in New York City.
It is estimated that as much as 60% of garment manufacturing is subcontracted to artisans working out of their homes. These are primarily women, working in developing economies and where it is very difficult to certify standards. We all know what so often occurs in circumstances like that, especially with no one advocating on these women's behalf. Enter Nest, a nonprofit organization founded in 2006 and which has taken up this cause with remarkable energy and creativity. And it's wonderful to have with us this evening its founder and executive director, Rebecca Van Bergen. Good evening, Rebecca, and welcome to The Business of Giving.
Thank you for having me.
Give us a snapshot of Nest and what the organization was created to do.
Our mission as an organization is to help empower the global community of artisan workers, but more than just grassroots impact for each of those businesses. We also want to rethink the way we as consumers, as brands, as anybody, think about the hand worker economy and what its potential is for supporting women globally.
You know, you started Nest in 2006 when you were only 24 and having just completed your master's in social work at Washington University in St. Louis. How did this story get started and how did Nest come to be?
Sure. The year that I graduated, Muhammad Yunus had just won the Nobel Peace Prize for microfinance, and in international development circles, at least, it was starting to be considered a solution to poverty, and people all over the world were starting to give out loans. And from the social work perspective, which is really sort of about individual practice with a woman or a man about kind of increasing their agency, microfinance seemed like it would carry a lot of challenges in that it's debt primarily. It doesn't mean that you'll have a successful business. And so I was really interested in kind of rethinking how business could support increasing women's agency around the world, but in a way that wasn't solely reliant on debt. Mm-hmm. And so our original mission, which is still today, was about how to support women artisans in particular. It's the second largest employer of women in developing economies. So it really seemed like the place where artists, where women were working to grow their businesses, with sort of an emphasis on the exporting marketplace, given that I was based here in the United States.
You know, you were in many ways destined to start a nonprofit. Your mother started one. Your aunt started one. Tell us about your upbringing and the influence that these two women, as well as your grandmother, had on your career path.
Sure. I mean, I think I only realized some of it later in life, but
we always do.
My dad was a for-profit entrepreneur. My mom did start a nonprofit. My aunt started a nonprofit just 2 years ago. My sister did. So it clearly runs in the family, both entrepreneurship, but then also, while my dad was a for-profit entrepreneur, the others were nonprofits. So the kind of social justice was a big part of my childhood and childhood discussions. We were involved politically and socially on a number of levels. But my grandmother was also originally from rural North Carolina, she grew up on a tobacco farm, and her mother was a quilter and sewer and was so by necessity. I mean, she made quilts out of rags, and like that was before upcycling was like a cool thing to do. Mm-hmm. And so, you know, craft was also a part of my life. My grandmother was always sewing. She made all my mom's clothes, and so I think it was only later that I realized that combination of things, seeing the power that craft has for women in particular, and then also this kind of, yes, inherent drive to do something with my life that was meaningful for social problems that I was seeing around me, kind of all combined in a perfect storm.
Yeah, it does seem to be a pretty good fit, doesn't it? Let me ask you, Rebecca, about the word artisan. What do you think that word conveys to most people, and do you think it portrays an accurate picture.
And I think it's interesting because when I started Nest now almost 13 years ago, nobody was using the word artisan. And now everybody is using the word artisan. We sort of keep a running joke list at the office of the bizarre ways you see the use of word, you know, the word artisan, like artisan hotel or artisan potato chips. Like, what does that actually mean? And so I think while there has been this kind of steady increase in the handmade and local and artisan, that's really good in a lot of ways. The downside to that is that it kind of dilutes what the term means for a lot of people. And so I think UNESCO actually has a definition of artisan around kind of the majority of the product being produced by hand, but it can include the use of some machinery or tools, which we really like. But, you know, I think it's a hard term to define. And mm-hmm. I think one of the things we'll start talking about is that there's a lot of people working in their homes with their hands that haven't necessarily been considered an artisan, and the work may or may not be skilled. And so artisan may or may not be the right term for them. So our organization, we've actually embraced the word handwork.
Right.
And we use it more often, actually, than artisan to really speak about the wide array of ways that women are using their hands as their primary source of income.
Yeah. And not only was artisan not being used 13 years ago when you started the organization, sustainable fashion really didn't exist either, did it?
No, it didn't. So there's been a lot of kind of industry trends around sustainable fashion, transparency, artisan that have really helped propel the work forward.
Yeah, yeah. You know, when you think of garment production, I think almost everybody thinks of those big old factories, with a lot of people working in those factories. But there is quite an invisible workforce that we've alluded to out there. Tell us about them.
Sure. I think, you know, I learned about this on the go. I think they're very invisible. So I think most people, including myself, didn't know a lot about this. But as we started looking into bringing transparency to artisans who are largely working in their homes or unregulated workshops, as brands were considering increasing their artisan sourcing, we all of a sudden had brands coming to us that didn't really have a quote-unquote artisan agenda or artisan products in their supply chain. And we really started realizing that there was a lot of production happening that was being subcontracted, which means that the factory gives that order to other people, mm-hmm. whether it's in a different factory or a different unregulated workshop or eventually into homes. And this is considered homework. But mm-hmm. historically in the industry, a lot of companies had quote unquote no homeworker policies where they forbid that type of subcontracting because they couldn't have transparency. But the unintended consequence of that was that it pushed a lot of it underground. So factories still did it. They just didn't tell anyone.
Right.
So it actually ended up kind of increasing the risk for those women in a lot of ways. But so that, you know, the statistic is actually that there's anywhere between 20-60%, right. which I actually love because it shows that nobody has any idea.
Nobody knows.
Like 20
well,
and 60 are like,
sparse, yeah.
It's very, very different numbers, exactly. And as we talked, the only way they find out is through disclosure or kind of happening upon it. And so it hasn't been formally tracked until now.
Yeah. And many of these women who work out of their homes really don't have any other choice, do they?
No, I think what, you know, we really advocate, like in my vision for 5 years from now, or maybe it will take 10, but hopefully just five. If you were a company or a brand or retailer and you said you had a no homeworker policy, that would be akin to saying I have an anti-woman policy. I mean, for so many of these women, they live in locations where their husbands might not allow them to work outside of the home. They might be rurally located, which would mean urban migration and leaving their families behind. And so there's so many reasons, childcare, disability, that women really rely on home-based work. And so those policies have had a negative effect for a lot of women, and we're really hoping that increased transparency can mean that homework is a viable option for women around mm-hmm. the world.
So, Rebecca, how does Nest work? I mean, what does it mean for an artisan to be part of the Nest Guild? Sure. And what are some of the benefits that you do give them?
Sure. So we work in sort of two ways in parallel that obviously intersect quite a bit. We're a nonprofit organization, and so the majority of our funding is philanthropy, and we invest in the global community of artisans. So we run what we call the Guild, which you just mentioned, which is an open access network for artisan businesses around the world. It's free to join. It's now over 500 businesses and a footprint of 92 countries, and we provide a range of resources for those businesses, including kind of one of our most active programs is a pro bono consulting program. So mm-hmm. anyone with skills, so listeners with skills, can volunteer their time and they get matched with an artisan business, whether it's accounting or product development or building a website. And so we kind of help support business growth through that program and a variety of others. And then the remainder of the time we spend consulting with brands and retailers that want to be investing in artisan supply chains but don't necessarily know how to do that ethically, with transparency, et cetera. And so we have a range of programs that really help ensure that when brands are buying from all of the artisans in our guild, they're doing so in a way that's sustainable and transparent.
How do artisans find you? And do they have to do anything to qualify to be part of this Nest Guild?
It's amazing. It's through word of mouth, I guess. I mean, we do outreach sometimes, too, and we travel a lot. But largely, they find out about it through others. And I think once you start giving away resources and the resources are free, people find out. So it grows. You know, the network actually grows by about 10% a month. So it's steadily growing without any kind of formal outreach or very little. And we do have some criteria. Obviously, you have to be an artisan business. Mm-hmm. So we make sure that you're actually practicing an artisan technique. And then as a nonprofit, we really do have an emphasis on artisan businesses that are using that business for good. And so you have to meet one social criteria. You have to be in an area of high poverty or high unemployment. You have to have a gender equity lens, so women leadership, majority women entrepreneur, women artisans, or cultural preservation, which is our most fuzzy, since that obviously is hard to totally define. But I'd say the majority of artisan businesses meet multiple of those criteria.
Well, let's talk a little bit about your business. You've had two very interesting pivot points, at least that I'm aware of, since you started in 2006. And the first was about 5 years in when you changed your business model. How did it change and what was the thinking behind it?
Sure. I mean, I think when we originally started, our goal was to help increase the market share for artisans. And so we were helping brands source directly from artisan communities and were acting like a middleman. We wanted to be an ethical middleman, but as a middleman. Yeah. So a brand wanted to produce a bag, we would connect with artisan business and produce that bag, and we made money on that. And so 90% of our revenue at the time came from producing product. But we really realized that by doing that, we were there was a lot of ethical issues with that business model. If a brand came to us and they wanted to produce and we knew sort of what their kind of price restrictions would be, often we'd know that our cut was what was making the goods prohibitively expensive. Mm-hmm. And so if we weren't involved, the artisan probably could get the order. And we also had no incentive to eventually have the artisan business work directly with the brand when they were capable of doing so, because that was how we were making money. And so to be making money in that way felt really uncomfortable to us. And we also didn't ever make enough to invest enough in training for the artisan workforce so that they could eventually sustain those relationships. And so it was a really hard decision.
I bet.
Because a lot of our revenue was coming that way. But we decided to just kind of clean slate it and switch to 100% philanthropy. And we did that. And it was really successful. And I think has kind of opened our eyes into transparency and how kind of supply chains get structured, even when they're with artisans and so well-meaning. It's really, really important that there's transparency all the way through.
Yeah, yeah. And also, I'm sure these artisans became dependent upon you.
Exactly.
And you wanted them to be able to stand up and grow their own business.
Exactly.
if you were not around. The second was several years later, and you alluded to this a few moments ago, and that is when you returned to your earned income model, but now in a completely different way and with brands. Tell us what that looks like and who you work with.
Sure. So I think we realized eventually that our brands were continuing to come to us. They never left after that was our kind of original model. And so we kind of had a odd relationship with them for a couple of years because we weren't charging them for, or we didn't know how to charge them for services, but they were getting benefits. And so we really switched more to a consulting model where we support brands that are still not a middleman. So if a company wants to source, we help them find the appropriate partner. But it's sort of a one-time arrangement. But I'd say the majority of our work with brands is really that as artisan has become increasingly popular, bigger and bigger companies want to source with artisans. And the bigger the company, the less likely it is that their systems are set up to work with small manufacturers. Mm-hmm. And so a lot of the work we do is around consulting with companies on how to create alternative kind of multifunctional pathways, how can that they can source from local makers or from artisans in a way that's different than how they onboard a factory. You know, like one of our partners is Target, and they have, you know, a binder for onboarding if you're a factory, and that would be really onerous for a small manufacturer. And so how can we create alternative solutions for kind of smaller manufacturers? And then I think we'll pivot to talking about transparency transparency, but that's a big piece of what we do with companies.
Yeah. And who are some of the other brands you work with?
We work with I think it's really interesting. We work with a huge range of companies from Target to Patagonia to Hermes. And, mm-hmm. What I love about craft is that we work with Target, which is about kind of democratizing the ability to purchase craft, to Hermes, which is about really supporting the most exquisite, the most skilled artisans in the world. And so that there's a place at the table for both of those conversations within a singular movement is really exciting to me. West Elm here has been one of our kind of founding and core partners, and they have a huge and sustained commitment to artisan handcraft. So we're really lucky to work with some Eileen Fisher, some amazing companies.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm. Technology is certainly vital to what you do. I just don't even know how you would ever go about trying to map this workforce, which is in homes and spread out across the world. Tell us about the Nest Remote Learning Center and the other ways that you've deployed technology.
Sure. I mean, I think technology is really critical on multiple levels. One, our global network, our guild, we want to deploy as much consulting and support to those people as possible. And while on-site is always the preference because you can meet face-to-face and it can be really impactful, it's not always possible. And so things like WeChat and Skype and email, just email, has been really profound in enabling us to provide support from afar to businesses on a capacity building front. On the transparency front, I think it's been interesting in two ways. One, I think even less about kind of the services we use. I think the writing is on the wall for everybody in the industry. The transparency is coming whether or not you like it. And so, things like blockchain and, we're not technically using blockchain yet, but I think people are fearful and or anticipatory that that's going to kind of take over and transparency will exist. So I think there's kind of a rush by the industry to better map their supply chains and know who's in them. Prior to people finding out without the brand's consent. And so I think that technology has really spurred the movement towards supply chain mapping for a lot of companies. And I think it shows a lot of promise for us. Right now, we use technology minimally. We actually do go sort of door-to-door, for lack of a better word, to meet with the home workers face-to-face. But you could, and right now when we get on-site, generally there's not paper records, let alone digital ones. And so we really kind of are starting at the beginning. But you can see a day where instead of needing to have a paper wage receipt, you're being paid mobile money. And mm-hmm. so then there is documentation, which would make our lives easier, certainly. But it's sort of one step at a time. I think we don't want to scare anyone.
Your organization is dealing with this on so many different levels. And one of those would be the Nest Standards in Seal. How does that work?
Sure. And I think one of the things, when we started the Guild, and so we have this network in 92 countries, one of the benefits of that was it kind of gave – people think of artisan as very localized and very niche. Mm-hmm. And that's because it is in many ways. It's, traditions that have been passed down generationally. It's very tied to people's sense of community and family. But it's also this global workforce with massive economic implications for women. And I think that part of the story gets lost all the time in terms of how important this sector is. And it's been very under-supported in a lot of ways because I think of this misconception that it's very niche. And so one of the things that the Guild has provided us is this kind of global pulse on what are the challenges that are happening in Guatemala and in Swaziland and in Peru and in India and are happening everywhere, and how can we kind of help solve some of those sector-wide hurdles. And one of them was transparency, because they're working in homes. And so if a company wanted to do it ethically, what does that even look like? Because they're not set up to go door to door and see all of the artisans that they're working with. And so we had a tool we had developed called the Artisan Audit, which we used internally to make sure that we knew what was happening in the supply chains we were working with. And we were approached by West Elm actually about 4 years ago, whether we would turn that tool into an industry facing tool. Mm-hmm. And so we did some diligence, and we couldn't believe that it was possible that there wasn't an industry standard for artisan or home-based work, but it turns out there wasn't.
Nope.
And so we really decided that if we were going to go down that journey, we wanted to do it for the industry at large, not just as kind of a singular partnership. And West Elm was really on board with that, because I think there's a lot of redundancy in factories where there's actually a joke, and it's true, but factories will sometimes have four fire extinguishers because four different companies will have the requirement that you have to have one, but at different heights. And it's easier to have four than to change it every time someone's coming. And that's like a legitimate thing that's happening because people kind of want it alone. So we put together a committee of brands, many of the ones I mentioned to you, and we spent 3 years co-authoring, piloting, refining the first industry standard for home-based work. We piloted in over 50 locations and worked with many labor organizations, many of our artisan partners to get their feedback, held roundtables with artisans and the brands to talk about child labor and some of the thornier issues, and then ended up launching this standard at the United Nations last year, which it was really exciting, and now has many companies have adopted it as their kind of standard operating procedure. And then one of the biggest services we provide brands is, you know, kind of quote unquote auditing to that standard, so going into their supply chains and mapping them. And then if passing artisan businesses carries a seal. So the seal actually just launched in West Elm in December.
Well, congratulations. That is a major, major milestone. You know, I was just thinking about a woman's hands who's doing these repetitive motions, which are required day after day to do this work. And I thought that, number one, it could be very meditative. But on the other hand, I thought it also could lead to a lot of physical ailments. Is either the case?
Both are the case. Yeah. I think repetitive, there have many forms of craft have been linked to the same brain changes that meditation provides. And so I think it is very true that it is meditative. I think it's also very true that it is bad for your hands. It's bad for your eyes. A lot of the craft techniques have been passed down without kind of a look at ergonomics. So they're, you know, sitting in uncomfortable positions at looms and, you know, a lot. So there, I think there's a lot of kind of health things that need to be looked at it, especially when hours are long or production is high. And so so we really take as part of our compliance program, we look at health and safety. We make a lot of recommendations around ensuring that the time that they're spending doing the craft make sure it doesn't kind of cross into the territory of it being dangerous. I think the bigger thing about craft and the repetitive nature is that I think that there's been kind of there is a movement that thinks that kind of a cultural preservation movement, that people think that these crafts need to stay the same. And I think that there's a lot to lose by viewing craft that way. I think there's a lot to gain from thinking of craft as something artistic and creative, and that communities can iterate and design can iterate, and that that's one of the things that will keep kind of a younger generation coming back.
Well, picking up on that a little bit, you know, I have a colleague who's in the antiquing business, and she was saying that it's pretty much dead in the water right now because people by and large, but young people in particular, millennials, really don't care about antiques. Do you think the same thing could ever happen to handmade?
I hope not, but I think one of the things that's been really interesting to me is that we've never been asked that specific question, but we get asked about automation all the time and like the rise of production transferring to robotics. And I think what's been really interesting is that you've seen a steady increase in the demand for handmade rising at the same speed and at the same time as the rise of automation. And I think, in robotics in particular. And I think that people who work at a sewing line have a right to fear for their jobs in some ways, because I think robotics is moving. I think that it's coming.
Yeah, like transparency.
Exactly. I think the opposite is true for handmade, and that I think that like the human psyche is not going to be comfortable with everything being technology-based and robotics-based. And so I think that there's this yearning for the handmade, which is what we're seeing now, this kind of boom in like gig economy and local and all of these terms. Exactly. And so I think that we're actually lucky in that I think that those are going to rise at equal pace, because I think that the more things are made mass produced exactly the same by a machine, the more people are going to want authenticity and real handmade goods. And
so I hope you're right.
I hope I'm right too. So far, I think we're seeing that.
Yeah, yeah. You know, we talked about some of the brands that you work with. Who have been some of your contributors, your financial partners?
We've been very lucky. We have an incredible group of some of the world's best philanthropists, honestly, and they've taught me. So as a 24-year-old when I started it, I had a lot to learn about global development, but we're funded by Bloomberg Philanthropies here in the city, and their economic development portfolio has been fantastic, and I've learned an enormous amount from them. So we're hugely grateful for their support. We're funded by the Swarovski Foundation, the Imago Dei Foundation, which is based in Boston. Yeah. I've been a fellow of a number of social enterprise programs, so Ashoka, Draper Richards Kaplan. I'm a young global leader, so we have a kind of range of social entrepreneurship support, which has been also very helpful for kind of my leadership growth. But so, you know, we've been really lucky that I feel like we work with some of the best partners. I do think what I was saying earlier about kind of the misconception that artisan is niche and non-scalable has meant that some major philanthropies have not looked at this sector. That they've seen agriculture and technology and health and a whole range of issues that relate directly to women in emerging markets, and have not seen artisan that way. And I think that tide is changing. I think people are really recognizing that this is where women are working, and that if you want to make a play for economic development for women, then this needs to be part of the conversation. And I'm hopeful we're playing a role in that.
Yeah, I think you are, absolutely. I mean, you're helping define that sector. If you said 20% to 60%, that's a broad thing. The more you can begin to get that exact, the more people begin to see the breadth and scope of all this, I think the more money is going to be coming your way. Well, talking about learning, you've been doing this for 12, 13 years right now. What have you learned about scaling and growing a successful nonprofit organization?
Oh, my goodness. I've learned everything. I knew nothing when I started looking back on it. But I think knowing nothing was actually a really helpful way to start, because I had no conception that I knew anything. So I learned constantly. Mm-hmm. I think my dad is an entrepreneur, too. And when I called him to tell him I wanted to start Nest, he was like, great, you know, send me your business plan, send me your financials. Like, to him, entrepreneurship was very linear in the way he thought about it. Like, you know, you start a business, you grow it, you sell it. And for me, it was very circular. And the more, you know, it was relational. I called people that I knew and asked for help. And that led me to a lawyer and a PR consultant, all these things of people who felt inspired and joined the movement. And our growth has been very organic. I think it took me like 2.5 years to write our first business plan. And by then, we like had a business.
And your dad was fed up.
Exactly. I think he didn't totally understand that. But the more that I've worked with women entrepreneurs and social entrepreneurs, and I've really seen that like kind of circular business creation is a legitimate way to run a business and start a business. It's just not the traditional kind of male-centric version. And so I think I've kind of become a vocal advocate for alternative entrepreneurship models and how you can think about growing a business when that's maybe not the way you see growth.
What's it like to work at Nest, and what do you think makes it a special place to work? What's really distinctive about your corporate culture?
You know, I think there's multiple things, but I think the biggest one is that, you know, we're called Nest, which is, you know,
great name.
It was about kind of supporting, obviously, businesses and helping them kind of go off on their own. But I think it really relates to the way our organization feels and runs. My husband is our COO, CFO, and has been my business partner for a very long time. And so in many ways, it is a family and it's run by a couple. And so I think there is definitely that kind of familial element to it. Our trustees, we have, you know, many of them have been with the organization for multiple terms and are very, very close to the organization. So I think, you know, as a nonprofit, we can't pay what a for-profit company could to recruit the best employees. And so, you know, I'm really hopeful that kind of the creative environment, it's fast-paced, we're always changing, we're very nimble, makes it an exciting place to work. And I think we're, you know, we've seen rapid growth and see a lot of growth on the horizon. And so I think hopefully, you know, people like that kind of, we're not totally sure what's coming next, but we're ready for it kind of environment.
Well, I know that you're pretty much open to any idea that comes along, which is probably your greatest strength and maybe your greatest weakness. You know what I mean?
Many would say that, yes.
You know, when it comes to this work, Rebecca, the products that are crafted and produced, as well as the women who do all this day after day after day, what should listeners know and be aware of as it pertains to that?
I mean, I think there's so many ways now with the growth in the kind of handworker economy, as we like to call it, that consumers can be very, very involved in this economy. I mean, they're everything from, you know, Etsy and shopping local to now big companies and being able to just go to your local Target and buy a basket that was handmade. And so I think there's, and with the increase in transparency, there's very real ways and that people can get involved. I think one of the things that I'm a big proponent of is that I think that we're very black and white as a culture. And so you're either a vegetarian or you're not. And, you know, there's lots of shades of gray. You can eat vegetarian once a week and you can be helping kind of eliminate, support environmental practices. And so, you know, I think people get very nervous around ethical fashion and sustainable purchasing because it seems overwhelming. And like, how could I possibly change all of my purchasing practices? Don't, you know, start with one thing. Yeah. You know, we buy all of whenever we have to buy a present for someone, we buy it locally in our town because it's an easy way to always remember to go to a local store. And so find very easy, very specific ways that you can start changing the way you're purchasing things. And it doesn't have to be all or nothing. Mm-hmm. And so I think, you know, it's really important to remember that we can just take small steps and those small steps add. And so, I'm a really big proponent of that.
Just get started.
Exactly.
Mm-hmm. Let me close with this, Rebecca. Share with us one of your favorite Nest stories that helps inspire you and carry on with this work.
Sure. There's so many, but I think one of the things that I'm particularly been reflective on recently is the kind of intersection between the artisan business leadership that we work with and kind of activism. And I think we're in such a strange time globally. And I think, so I've been thinking a lot about activism and what that means. And reflecting back, you know, one of the first artisan entrepreneurs that we worked with was in Togo, West Africa, and she was a boutique artisan, and she had a number of women that worked with her. And when I was visiting with her, she had, this is probably a little funny to say on air, but she had a wooden penis on her, like right next to her sewing machine. And I was like, what? Why do you have that? And she was like, well, because I hold condom workshops after work. Mm-hmm. And of course she does, because she was a center for the community, and that's where women came to work, and they respected her and listened to her. And so it was really important that she leveraged that. And, you know, similarly, we have a woman here in our guild who's in Mississippi, and she decided to take time off from her business, which was making hand-carved wooden boxes, to run for political office because she realized that she had a voice in her community. And I think the great thing about social entrepreneurs is that they do have this kind of vision for the community. And sometimes that means growing your business. And sometimes that means you can do much more for the problems you're seeing around you. And so I think we're really inspired by them every day.
Well, Rebecca Van Bergen, the founder and executive director of Nest, I want to thank you so much for being here this evening. Tell us about your website and some of the information that listeners will find there.
Sure. Our website is buildanest.org. And on the website, you can find obviously all the information about us, but there's volunteer opportunities if you want to be a pro bono consultant for Artisan Network. You can find information about the brands that carry the Nest seal so you can buy ethically produced product. So there's a kind of a range of information for listeners.
Including donating.
Including donating, yes. Thank you.
Thanks, Rebecca. It was a real pleasure to have you on the show.
Thank you.
I'll be back with more of The Business of Giving right after this.
The Business of Giving can be heard every Sunday evening between 6 and 7 p.m. Eastern on AM 970 The Answer in New York and on iHeartRadio. You can follow us at Biz of Give on Twitter and at Facebook.com/Business of Giving.
3-star general Michael J. Flynn, head of the Pentagon Intelligence Agency, knew all the government's dirty secrets.
He was one of the most respected generals in the military.
Flynn knew what the intel world had been up to. He understood its funding.
He ordered the first audit of the use of contractors. This set off alarm bells.
The explosive new documentary, Flynn, Deliver the Truth, Whatever the Cost, and covers the facts behind this scandal.
Flynn told the truth. He was the most dangerous person for Donald Trump to hire.
I find out the worst enemy that I'm going to face in my life is right here in America. They took my assessment and they wanted me to change it. And I was like, I'm not changing it.
They had to get rid of Flynn.
With in-depth interviews, archival footage, and never-before-seen personal records of the man behind the headlines.
I just felt like I was drowning.
Flynn, Deliver the Truth, Whatever the Cost. Available now. Watch it today. Go to SalemNow.com. SalemNow.com.